And then at the end of that, I realized the whole thing was just a total bust. So I spent the next semester learning how to blow glass. Going down to the glass blower and learning how to turn it into brush. And that was helpful and useful all my life to know, be able to do a fair amount of reasonable glass blowing.
What kind of a person was Noller? The time you were
aloof, a little apart, but a nice person, as I remember him. I sort of kept a distance from him.
Anybody else work for him at the same time during that 1 year?
Not that I can remember. Probably there was, but I don't remember whom.
Well, certainly it wasn't. Couldn't have expected it would have turned into a thesis problem. Was that?
God knows what it was supposed to do. So I then ended up with him leaving. That's right. And it was announced that and so now you better find somebody. Well, Louis was the only guy, right? So I asked Louis if I could come around and see him, and he said, "Well, I'm terribly busy, but maybe I can see you in 3 days at 2 o'clock in the morning." I said, "Fun." But meanwhile, as I asked around, of course, what I found out that Louis was in the process of stealing vitamin K from Doisy. And there wasn't any question that it was just saying, plain simple, stealing in my mind. Poor old Doisy would be sending these communications into the Journal of the American Chemical Society, the editor of which was Arthur Beckett Lamb, sitting there in an office. He would call Louis in to referee the papers. Louis lived under the illusion that all quinones belonged to him. That anybody who was doing anything with a quinone had stolen it from him. So that was his rationalization for taking this hot stuff, going into his laboratory, repeating it, carrying it on a few steps further. So everyone was mobilized literally to work the whole night through. I mean, and if you go back to the literature of that time, you find poor Doisy, who was really the sole contributor to that, having the thing pulled out from under him by Louis. Well, at that time, I was still idealistic, and I can imagine that maybe I still am, but I'm a little more realistic, and I guess that kind of thing happens more. But I was really so profoundly, deeply offended that I said, if there's no one else to work with, I'm just leaving chemistry. Mm. I found it absolutely appalling behavior. So that summer, then they said, well, a new professor is coming from England, Linstead. And I decided, without even having seen him, that I would work for him, because I certainly couldn't work with Louis. And so then I just pulled off, took a little bit of my remaining money and went to Europe and bought a bicycle in Bremen when I landed, and spent a couple of months bicycling around Germany alone. And it was at that time, that year, that I found this little book by Erich Huckel on the theoretical foundation of organic chemistry, the Theoretische Grundlage der organischen Chemie. And I saw this in a window in Heidelberg. And I said, well, God, I've never heard of anything like that. And then I paced through the book. I've never seen anything like that. thought, well, hell, I'll buy it. See what sense I can make of it. So I kept on bicycling, and finally the youth hostels were beginning to empty out, and I couldn't understand why. Maybe everybody was going. I didn't read a newspaper or hear a radio or do anything. Literally bicycling, and then when I would get to a place like Munich, I would go to the opera, and, you know, as a student, you could go for practically nothing, so that you really weren't spending much money at all. And bicycled, went to Freiburg, and bicycled up through the Black Forest, and down the Rhine again, and and then it was clear something was happening, although I didn't have a clue what it might be, because these people in civilian clothes were, you know, men were getting into groups in the square and marching and so forth. And I thought, well, that's so silly. And I took a picture of one of them in one of those small Rhine villages, and they were promptly in the police station for having done it. Had the film confiscated. So the war broke out, and I bicycled on to Cologne, where I met a Texan, who had an auto car. And I convinced him that there was absolutely no point going to places like Holland and so forth, because the Germans would invade immediately, and we'd never get out that way, but we should drive to Denmark, where I had relatives. So I convinced him to drive to Denmark, and that was a good thing. And we finally got back on a freighter. And there was Lindstedt. And he had a...
This would be the fall of...
39. Yeah. October, and he suggested a problem on stereochemistry of reduction of catalytic reduction of... well, that's the general subject. And diphenic acid, diphenyl, with two carboxylic acid groups... being the substrate we would work on, and there were six stereoisomers of the perhydrodiphenic acids, and so my job was to make them and isolate them and so forth. And that, you know, I enjoyed that very much. Didn't see much of Lindstedt because Burton K. Wheeler was a senator at the time, and just before Lindstedt arrived, Wheeler, who was rather strongly opposed to our getting into the war, said, "Beware of Lindstedt. He's being sent over here by the British government to get U.S. science involved in the war effort." And Conant was very upset about all of that scandal and so forth, but it turned out to be true. So Lindstedt spent most of his time down at the British Embassy in Washington, and I would see him once in a while. He pronounced my name Daring. But I liked him very much, and the problem was a great problem. I mean, very demanding in the laboratory. And I can remember Steve Marvel had made one of these stereoisomers and wanted to know whether it was identical. And so Lindstedt wrote to him for a sample, and he sent on a sample of about 4 or 5 milligrams. And I began fooling with it, and it clearly it wasn't pure. So by crystallization separates, fractional crystallization separated it into two isomers and we figured out which was which and wrapped them back up and sent them back 2 milligrams of each of these two acids. And I guess Marvel never forgot it because he never had a great affection. The rumor is that I would have had the Welsh Prize long before this if it hadn't been for Marble sitting there blackballing it every time.
I'm sure he was on their committee.
Yeah. Every time it came up.
That's a
oh, dear. Well, you can tell I had a great deal of fun out of it all.
You know, when you started that work, you really, in terms of the laboratory aspects, you were really required to refine those classical techniques, working with small quantities.
Yeah.
Was it just that training from Fieser's course where you said sort of synthesize everything and learned all the basic techniques at that time that you then applied to these?
Yeah, I don't think it was any question about that. But I would add to it a personal quality, that is of taking great, great pride
mm-hmm.
in what emerged from anything I did with my hands, and and falling in love with crystals, as many organic chemists did.
Mm-hmm.
But it isn't that meant to say that there was real joy and real joy in carrying out one of those fractional crystallizations where you moved across that stupid triangle and,
yes.
and developed new techniques for that.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the techniques for handling what you wouldn't call small quantities now, but quantities in the sort of half to 5 milligram range, one of the techniques I developed for that is in Weiberg's laboratory textbook. Nifty technique, just using standard cheap little 10 by 75 millimeter lipless tubes. So it was interesting that there were some other people around who, at that time, who got a lot of their jollies from refining techniques and developing new techniques. One of the persons working with Fieser, not as a graduate student, but I think as a postdoc or a senior laboratory assistant, was E.B. Hirschberg, for whom the Hirschberg stirrer was known. Well, God, I mean, you make a new stirrer today, you're going to have your head in your lap, right? But in those days, taking a rod, making a little circle at the bottom, and a piece of nichrome wire, and a recipe for how you turned it around, cork bore, appropriate diameter, and finally got it so that it would make contact with the bottom of a round bottom flask and so forth. These were considered significant advances. And I was, I was really heavily into that. Oh, God.
I have a question which I'm not sure if it fits here, but let me at least throw it in. Because there's a great move today to move undergraduate organic chemistry laboratory work to the micro scale.
Yeah.
How do you view that? I mean, I know what the safety and consumption requirements advantages are, but in terms of pedagogy, do students get the same feel for organic chemistry that you got when you started out in the lab?
I kind of doubt it. And one reason I doubt it is for having created a new course shortly after I arrived at Harvard, which was designed to make up for the the lack in, well, what do you say, the feeling for manipulating organic chemicals. So it was a course that would be taken by juniors and seniors, small course, limited to perhaps 20 students, so you weren't trying to do it for all 200, including the pre-meds. Did it make any difference whether they had a feeling for organic chemicals? Well, it depends on your attitude toward croakers in general. And and in this course, you were taught, you were given the opportunity to work on large scale and medium scale and so forth, and carry out fractional distillations and do a variety, you know, a variety, have a gain experience with a variety of what you would call classical techniques that were going out of the, by that time even, were going out of the elementary lab, and part because of expense and then later because of concern for safety. Mm-hmm. And that, and then you would give these guys a little problem that involved repeating two or three steps in the literature, but would end up with the possibility of doing something new, so that they were mini research problems. But well, that course still is one of the most successful at Harvard, and it does two things for the persons who don't enjoy working with their hands and, you know, who don't ultimately embrace the pleasures to be derived from organic chemical laboratory. It was very important in convincing them that experimental organic chemistry wasn't their cup of tea, and this is not what they're trying to do. On the other side, were the persons who just thought, well, this is marvelous, and now I'm going to go on. So it was good both for first-year graduate students who'd had a poor experimental background. They got into research much faster as a consequence of it. So that's a roundabout answer to your question. Do they lose something with by handling only organic chemicals at the micro level? It's very hard to know what one really learns in the laboratory about the intellectual aspect of organic chemistry. In my mind, they're divided, they're really separate. That is, that it doesn't really make much difference to me that benzene is a liquid and benzoic acid is a crystal. I mean, in terms of my understanding of organic chemistry, makes a big difference to know that whenever you run a reaction in organic chemistry, you're bound to get a mess. And the problem is how to untangle it.
That's true.
And it's really just two separate categories. It's important to know what, to guess what's in the mess, that's true. But really the pleasure that I got and would still be getting and would have gotten all my life if I continued working in the laboratory was enormous. An incredible gratification. Doing the job nicely, a sense of self-satisfaction is not to go around to anyone else and say, I, you know, stuck in my thumb and came out with a plum or whatever it is. It's just this profound satisfaction from doing it nicely and have it work out. Boy, by today you get these postdocs. Honestly, crystallization is a dead art. And you can't convince them that nature gave you this marvelous technique that by and large beats HPLC and various other separation. I mean, by and large, a crystal is the most demanding, most selective, most discriminating device for separation that we have. And, God, to teach them how to do it when they're 28 years old.
Where we?
And they think you're left over from the cave age. Well, I am. But
to them, yes. But we've trained a generation of instrumentalists now.
Yes.
Put instruments down as low in the curriculum as possible.
That's closely related to a television set as you can get.
Yes. And that's why a simple, I've noticed that, simple questions they think of the most complicated answers.
Yes.
Because they're thinking, they're tuned to thinking in instruments. This instrument does this, this one. They're all great techniques.
Of course.
But sometimes you can get a quick answer without ever touching one.
Absolutely.
And that's the part they miss, I think.
Oh, they...
And that's the fun of it, isn't it? To be able to logically work your way through the puzzle and come out with that answer at the end.
Yeah. Well, and to solve it with your own hands, mm-hmm. as opposed to somehow seeing the instrument. But even the operation of instruments is a funny thing. I mean, I now believe in a mystical sense that it's possible to learn the language in which that instrument talks, and to become sensitive to it, so that you know whether you're working the NMR machine at its limit, or you're less demanding, or how you got to handle that capillary GC to get the... God, I just was raking over the coals. A guy who comes from China, and all right, so what should he know about all these things? But in any event, he had been using the... the high resolution capillary GC, so damped that he could go back to his boss with a curve that had an absolutely straight baseline, right? The two peaks that he thought we were interested in when we were measuring the kinetics, the big one and the little one, alone showing in a reaction that I know gives 9 other products. But right, he had turned those off, mm-hmm. by putting in a damping factor. And then his surprise, when I said, but you weren't operating the instrument. You deliberately operated the instrument as a cheap, crude, half-blinded detector.
Yeah.
No sense. I mean, just sort of Well, what an unreasonable attitude. Look at these beautiful spectra. I mean, so there is some... It's very easy to let these instruments deceive you in certain ways. And some people are much better at it. And what I say is they develop a rapport with it, that it... There's a feedback loop. I mean, they look at that curve and they say, well, this is the way it's talking to me. It's ringing or it's doing this. And other people are oblivious to it.
It's like Ansager reading an equation.
Yes. Yes. It's a different language, and some people learn to... Well, anyway, I learned to read the language of crystals.
Let's come back then to the... And certainly that showed through those three papers you had with Lindstedt. Those really three papers on things.
It's a nice piece of work in retrospect.
Yeah. It's some beautiful stereochemistry in there. And it's, apparently it was pretty... It wasn't straightforward kinds of stereochemistry you were dealing with at
no.
all.
No.
So... I was not clear on the timetable, because you did a number of things. We have to get into meeting Woodward, but when did you get your PhD? What year was that?
I did not, in fact, get my PhD until 1943. I had finished up all the work 2 years earlier, in 41.
Okay.
And all right. I've had a terrible hang-up all my life about writing anything, be it a letter. There was one thing I didn't learn at Shady Hill School or at Belmont Hill School, it was how to write. I mean, I'm essentially illiterate.
You never know that by your papers in the literature.
But I, you know, I, it's not something I do with pleasure. It's very hard for me. And it takes several drafts. It's not until the word processor came along that I really get pleasure out of it, because I can now revise a paragraph 23 times without having a secretary look at me. I've just gone over the cliff forever.
Somewhere in that time period, then, and I guess that answers my question, because you were working on anti-mustard gas compounds on a war project in there, somewhere in there.
Right. I think, yes, there was just a series of...
Was that with Fieser?
The thing with Fieser was to develop a new explosives. God, what was the compound we were after? Oh, yes. Trinitrophenyl, right? Mm-hmm. But it was a trinitrobenzyl nitrate. So it's essentially trinitrobenzene with a CH2 nitrate. And the first thing one did in that reaction... This is typical Louis chemistry. You got hold of some TNT. Listen to this. You put it, you remember those heavy carrier tubes, which had, they would, for some sort of analysis where you digested something with nitric acid at high temperature. And so these were eighth-inch thick tubes, right, about an inch in diameter and a couple of feet long. So you put in about 20 or 30 grams of TNT. You poured a little excess of bromine, no solvent. You sealed the damn tube. You put it in a bomb. An iron bomb, you know, with a wire wrapped around it to raise the temperature. Well, dear God. Now this, the laboratories at Harvard were so arranged that there was an indentation in the wall where the windows were, so that, in effect, if you put the heating tube in that little space, then if it blew up, the glass would hit this little part of the wall on the left and the other left. Well, of course, half the tubes blew up. The laboratory would be filled with broken. And you wondered, when is the TNT going to detonate? Powdered glass blowing all over the place. It was powdered so finely that you didn't get cut or anything. Then you treated this trinitrile benzyl bromide with silver nitrate. God. This I was doing about the end of the time that a very close lifelong friend of mine, Richard B. Turner, who later became a professor at Rice, and he were, and I were in the same class of Harvard College. And